Termite damage. Termite damage can be your friend or your foe. Where the damage is fairly minor, limited in extent, and it's superficial, this can be fairly easily fixed. Where the damage is much more extensive and affects the structural integrity of the building, then clearly this can have a significant impact on your project if you intend to keep the building. Understanding the extent of the damage up front is critical, because if found too late, it could become a significant issue in terms of cost, time delay, and stress. A building and pest report should pick up any potential issues as long as the inspector could get full access to the property. Building compliance. Doing your research to ensure that the property you are considering is building compliant is very important. For example, smoke alarms, safety switches, and pool safety are now covered off on most purchase contracts. Things that are left to you to confirm, though, are things like whether the stairs are compliant, the hand railings, the use of thickened safety glass, etc. A building inspection report is beneficial to unearth these potential non-compliance issues, but do not just file it away without taking action, particularly if you intend to tenant the property. Another aspect when you are looking at a high-set dwelling is whether the downstairs is actually legal height. If not, your plans to turn it into a habitable living space may be dashed, and if you choose to proceed without approval, you could find your insurance to be null and void. Easements. Easements were touched on earlier in this module. An easement is the term used for an area of land on a property that gives someone or some entity the right to use that land for a specific purpose, even though they are not the landowner. A registered easement is actually noted on the title of the property, for example, a major power line easement or a shared driveway access easement. There are examples below. Other easements that are not registered and shown on the title, but are still as relevant, are called statutory easements like power lines, telephone lines, drainage and sewer easements. To build over statutory easements, you will need consent from the local council. For other easements, you will need consent from whomever the easement is vested in. Do not assume, though, that you will be given consent to build over an easement. In fact, there are many councils that will not allow you to build over a sewer main easement, for example. Instead, they may require you to leave a 1.5 metre wide clearance either side of the main, which equates to a 3 metre wide buffer over which you cannot build a structure, not even a carport. There's an example below. Clearly, if this cuts through the middle of your development site, it can have a major implication on the development potential of the site, the development layout, and the ultimate cost of the project. In order to identify the presence of easements on a parcel of land, you will need to do a title search to identify the registered easements. You will also need to identify where the services are located on the property and research if there are easement setbacks involved. Council and the utility providers will be able to identify these for you. Encroachments. An encroachment is where part of a neighbour's property has extended beyond their boundary into your boundary. Or, of course, the opposite, where a part of your property has extended into their property. Classic examples are fences, sheds, and in more extreme cases, actual parts of the building. There was a recent example of where the neighbour's house gutter plus fence actually projected onto the neighbouring house lot. There's a diagram below. Of course, an encroachment is especially a problem if you are looking to develop the property in the future. This is because with any development, whether it's a subdivision, multi-unit, or even a granny flat or dual occupancy dwelling, you will need to comply with council regulations, and in most cases, land size, block frontage, and setback to your neighbour are part of the regulations. So losing even half a metre along a 40 metre long boundary can make the difference between getting an extra unit or block of land on the site or not, because it affects the overall land size, the frontage width, and the setback to the neighbour. It can even be critical if you are doing a straight single house build and you are needing to build close to the boundaries, so ensuring there are no encroachments on the site is essential. Encroachments can be first picked up visually by looking along the boundary lines or fence lines, if they exist, but recognising that the fences can in fact be in the wrong position. The only real way to confirm an encroachment is to have a registered surveyor undertake a survey of the site. This might initially be a contour survey, which you will need in any case for a council development application or building approval. If this survey raises any concerns regarding encroachments, incorrect boundary lines, or indeed different total land size or boundary lengths than you expected, then you may need to have a full identification survey completed, which does come at a higher price. This is because within an identification survey, the exact boundaries are located and pegged. It will definitely be essential to have this survey completed if you are to prove to the neighbours that there is in fact an encroachment issue. It is highly recommended that you have at least the contour survey complete while you are in the conditional phase of the purchase contract, because if an issue is identified, you have time to negotiate on it and, if necessary, pull out of the contract. Whereas, if you wait until the contract is unconditional, it may be more difficult for you to get out of the deal if you need to. For example, if the deal stacks up as a three-unit site and then you find out that because of an encroachment you can only develop two units, then clearly if the deal no longer looks profitable, then you do not want to proceed with the purchase. You do not want to get stuck with it and then have to try to resell it now as a two-unit site, or spend the next 6 months negotiating with the neighbour to have the issue resolved, all the while unable to proceed with your development plans. Covenants. Covenants have been discussed earlier on in this module, but they definitely need to be part of your due diligence. This is because a covenant in an area can significantly impact on what can be built there, the size, the materials, even the colours used. It can also restrict the height of buildings where views are being preserved. The relocation of buildings into the area may also be prohibited, as a covenant aims to uphold a certain level of finish in an estate. Even prefabricated buildings may fall into this category, even though they are brand new, and so you need to do your research. The property title should list if any covenants are noted. There is some debate about the longevity and legality around covenants imposed by the original developer of an estate, particularly the older estates. And once the developer no longer owns land in the estate, there may be an opportunity to challenge these developer-imposed covenants. A solicitor is certainly the one to seek advice from in this regard. Caveat. Caveats were looked at in the option contract section above. From a due diligence perspective, you need to check the title to ensure a caveat has not been lodged on the title. If it has, it could delay you in purchasing the property or delay you in selling it. This is because a caveat registers the interest of another party on the property and prevents the property from being sold without all interested parties being advised. If there is a mortgage against the property, the bank is likely to have their interest in the property noted, so that you can't sell the property without repaying the bank. If a non-consenting caveat or a hostile caveat has been registered on the title, this is a sign of conflict with the property, because this caveat can be lodged without the consent of the landowner. A classic example is if a builder has not been paid for work on the property and the builder lodges a non-consenting caveat on the property title to protect the builder and prevent the owner from selling the property without the builder knowing. This type of caveat needs to be removed before settlement can take place, and clearly this could result in further dispute and negotiations between the parties and cost you in lost time and money. The alternative situation is a consenting caveat or a mutual caveat, that is one that has been lodged on the title with all parties' consent, including the landowner. A couple of classic examples of this is where there is an option contract on the property, or where someone has privately loaned money and taken this property as security. Again, this caveat needs to be removed prior to selling or buying a property. Your solicitor will be able to advise on this matter. Notations on registered survey plans. Every parcel of land is reflected on a registered survey plan. On older survey plans, handwritten or typed notations were sometimes made on the plan that affect what can be done with the land. Making sure you have diligently read every notation on the plan is important, especially if you intend to develop it or amend the title in any way. For example, there was a recent situation where two land lots were on the one title. The one at the front had road frontage, but the one at the rear was landlocked and had no legal access path. The strategy was to provide legal access to the rear site via a shared driveway on the front block, that way allowing separate title to be created for each block. What was interesting, though, was that during the process it was discovered that on the original survey plan there was a very faint handwritten note to say that the rear block could never be put onto its own separate title. Luckily, this was never picked up by council or the titles office, and the retitling went through without question. There were definitely a few sleepless nights waiting for the result, and if it had been picked up by the officials, it could have significantly delayed the project and added to the costs. Neighbour disputes and council show cause notice. When purchasing a property, you need to identify if there are any disputes with the neighbours. This may be a dispute over a tree, over a fence, or retaining wall, to name a few. The sale contract may show if there is a legal dispute over a tree. Talking with the neighbours will highlight if there are any issues going on. Contacting council will also reveal if any show cause notices have been issued or are in the process of being issued. This might be because an owner has excavated too close to a property boundary and it has the potential to undermine the neighbour's land, or worse still, affect buildings on their land. Other reasons to show cause may be if an owner is purposefully discharging runoff water onto another property, or even maybe noxious weeds are not being controlled, or the length of the grass is too long and is causing a hazard for harbouring snakes and vermin. There was a situation where the neighbour's dogs were being kept in substandard conditions, being fed raw meat and their waste not being cleaned up regularly enough, resulting in unfavourable odour and noise coming from over the fence, enough to turn off potential tenants and purchasers. You need to understand this history, because if you buy the property, you take on these issues. Impact of council overlays. Council overlays were looked at in Module 5, but they will be covered in more detail here because they are definitely something that you need to include in your due diligence on a property if you require council approval to complete your strategy. The type of overlays to be dealt with individually below include native vegetation protection areas, watercourses, flooding, overland flow, bushfire, slope, slip-prone areas, acid sulfate soil, and cultural heritage. Native vegetation protection zone. Most councils will have mapped the native vegetation in their local area, identified areas to be protected, and reflected this on their native vegetation protection zone maps. The areas may want to be protected for their ecological, flora and fauna values, their habitat for protected species like koala, as wildlife corridors or buffer zones, to name a few. In these zones, the clearing of vegetation may be restricted, and even if it is allowed, it may come with very stringent conditions on how it is done. For example, a fauna specialist may need to be hired to inspect every tree for significant native fauna and relocate anything found before the tree can be felled. Obviously, this could be a costly and time-consuming process depending on the number of trees to be felled. If your site is located in a vegetation protection zone, the vegetation clearing is required for you to undertake your project. Clearly, this could have an impact, and recognising it sooner rather than later is critical. On the flip side to this, though, you may be in a vegetation protection zone, but in fact have a property that is completely devoid of native vegetation. In this case, you will need to provide evidence of this to the council and have them approve this as an exemption if you are to avoid the impact of this overlay on your development. You would want to flag this with council early on in the process to ensure they will consider it as an exemption. Watercourse. A watercourse can be anything from a minor drainage line through to a seasonal stream, a permanent creek, all the way up to a major river. And most councils will have mapped these different levels of watercourses over their council area. Aesthetically and environmentally, having a watercourse like a creek on your property may be lovely. However, if your strategy is development, where council approval is involved, then a watercourse can be a big negative. The reason for this is that council is likely to specify a buffer distance from the top bank of the watercourse that any building works must be set back from. The larger the water body and the more permanent it is, the greater the buffer distance will be. So depending on the size of your block of land, you could end up with it all being consumed by buffer, and in fact none is able to be developed. The watercourse does not even have to be on your property to impact your site. For example, there may be a river a street or two away, and the buffer zone still may impact your property. Most councils will have this mapping online, but if not, you will need to inquire with council or with a consultant town planner to source this information and to clarify the potential impact on your property. There are some situations where a watercourse may exist, but may not be shown on the council mapping. In this instance, it is likely that council will pick up on it from the contour survey of the site or from the site inspection council may do, or even from aerial photographs. So do not ignore it and stick your head in the sand and hope it doesn't get picked up. because if it does, it could have an even bigger impact. Instead, you should consult an engineer to assess it and from there decide if further investigations are required, like completing a flood report on the watercourse to demonstrate its likely impact. Flooding. Similar to watercourses, your council may have a flood overlay map that shows the extent of flooding in the area, and there's an example below. All developments will need to comply with this overlay, and in fact even a residential house build will be impacted, and a minimum floor height is likely to be specified if the site is flood affected. Be mindful of the situation though, where your site is shown to be in a flood affected area, or right on the margin of a flood affected area, but in fact, due to the specific characteristics of your site, it does not actually flood, or only experiences minor flooding. Again, engaging an engineer to quantify the effect and represent it to council may provide you greater scope to then develop the site. There are also situations where localised flooding may occur and impact your site, but this is not shown on an official flood map. Clearly, this flooding occurrence can impact on what you plan to do to the property because you don't want to build even a garage in an area that may experience water ingress. Again, quantifying this early on is highly recommended. A great way to do this is to chat to some of the elderly folk in the street, because I guarantee that they will be able to tell you everything that has gone on in the area since they have been there. It is as simple as knocking on their door or chatting to them in the front garden. Mention to them that you are considering buying the property down the road or doing research on the property down the road, and ask if they know if it has experienced any localised flooding since they have lived there. Keep in mind that councils and main roads are always doing works to try to alleviate flooding, and so an area that did flood in the past may not do so now, if works have been done to mitigate it. The other important consideration with flooding is that even though you may have developed the site according to council's requirements, if you intend to sell the end product, there still may be challenges. What I mean by this is if, for example, you have developed units on the site or subdivided off blocks of land, the buyer's solicitor is likely to do their own flood search, and your property will still show up as being in a flood-affected area. You need to be prepared to tackle this head-on and be able to clearly demonstrate to the buyer and their solicitor how you have mitigated these effects and how any potential flooding will or will not affect the site. If you just ignore it, you run the risk of the buyer's solicitor recommending that their client not proceed with the purchase because it is too big a risk to take. Insurance is the other major consideration with properties in areas designated as flood affected. With the recent flooding events in Queensland and New South Wales, many of the insurance companies have tightened their regulations and will either not insure properties in flood affected areas or will have significantly increased their premiums. Getting quotes from numerous insurance companies is definitely recommended in this situation. Getting these quotes early on in the process is also highly advised, because the insurance premiums alone can turn a positive cash flow property into a negative if they are too high, and you want to know this before you proceed with the deal. If you are developing on the site and planning to sell, these high premiums will potentially affect the new owners too, and so you need to be prepared to address this in advance. Overland flow. Overland flow is where runoff water following a rain event flows over the ground surface of a property. Think of it differently from flooding because it is not associated with rising water from a watercourse. Instead, it is a sheet flow of runoff water before it reaches the watercourse. This water may accumulate from properties a distance away from you and flow through adjoining properties, including yours. The problem is where overland flow water concentrates in low-lying and gully areas where it can have the same effect as flooding. Most councils will not allow you to obstruct, impede, or redirect overland flow in a manner that it could affect other properties. For example, you cannot build up your land to construct a building or a retaining wall or a fence in the path of the water, because in doing so, you could cause the water to back up and be redirected onto someone else's property, thereby adversely affecting them because of what you did on your property. Instead, you need to manage the overland flow water on your site with stormwater infiltration and detention pits, and potentially other engineering measures, all of which is at a cost to your project. Depending on the extent of the flow, you may not be able to fully manage it. Also keep in mind that your insurance may be affected by this type of runoff water. Some policies will not cover water that has flowed through your property but has not come from the rising of a watercourse. In this instance, traditional flooding from a rising watercourse may be covered, but overland flow is not. This highlights that it is essential, therefore, to read your insurance policy carefully and understand the terminology. Some of the more resourced councils have mapped the overland flow paths in their shire and produced overland flow overlay maps that can be accessed from the council website. There's an example below. Similar to flood-affected sites, it is critical to identify overland flow-affected areas and do your due diligence in advance to understand its potential impacts on your strategy. And yes, there are also situations where your property may not be formally mapped as an overland flow path, but given the lay of the land, runoff from excessive rainfall can adversely impact. For example, where the block slopes away from the road or where your neighbour's block slopes towards yours and water runoff impacts your site. Do not think that the slope needs to be very steep either, as water will start to flow at even a small angle if enough falls in a short period of time. Looking at the contours of your property and identifying low-lying and gully-type areas is a good first step, as well as zooming out to look at the contours of the wider catchment that may drain onto your property. Also, look for storm water pipes in and around your property, as there will be a telltale sign that water accumulates in the area. Talking with neighbours is again a great way to quantify this potential effect. Ultimately, a civil engineer or hydraulics engineer will need to be consulted, and potentially a hydraulics report may need to be prepared. Bushfire. Bushfire has the potential to have a devastating effect on property and human life, and therefore legislation exists to ensure that people's lives are not put at risk from further development and construction in bushfire-prone areas. Councils will have mapped areas based on their exposure to the threat of bushfire, and this will impact on the site's capacity to be further developed. There's an example below. It will also impact on the construction requirements for any build, as the building code has set requirements when building in bushfire-prone areas. These construction regulations are very strict and require increasingly higher specification construction methods and materials, the higher the bushfire attack level rating is for the site. For example, on windows alone, instead of the standard fiberglass mesh fly screens, you will be required to install stainless steel mesh fly screens or even fire shutters on the windows, if the BAL rating is high for where you propose to build. There are six categories of rating, from BAL low, 12.5, 19, 29, 40 to flame zone, and a suitably qualified bushfire consultant will be required to rate the site and produce a BAL assessment certificate or bushfire assessment report depending on your project. Because a BAL rating in a bushfire prone area can significantly impact the capacity to develop a site, the on-site position of a build, and the construction method, the cost to do a project could quite easily become non-viable. For this reason, bushfire risk is something that you want to quantify as soon as possible in your due diligence process. Slope. The slope of the site has a diversity of impacts, which individually can have significant repercussions on your project, but in combination, they could be a showstopper. Therefore, identifying them and researching them upfront is important. Let me outline some of the potential impacts here. Firstly, most councils reduce the development intensity of a site the steeper it is. So, for example, a medium density site with a slope of less than 5% would be able to be developed into 4 units, whereas the exact same site, but with a greater than 20% slope, would only be able to have 2 units developed. Clearly, this can significantly affect the development potential of the site, and you need to understand council's policies up front by consulting with a town planner or researching it from the council website. As was outlined earlier, slope affects the runoff of water, so a site that slopes away from the road can be problematic for managing stormwater runoff. This is particularly relevant if you plan to develop the site, because in most councils you will not be allowed to discharge runoff water onto a neighbouring property, and instead you need to manage the runoff on your own site. This may involve installing storm water pits to capture the runoff water and discharge it to the street, or alternatively installing soaker pits to dissipate the water underground. But again, not all councils are accepting of this approach. The steeper the site, the more expensive building typically becomes, not only because of the need for scaffolding at height, but also the cost to cut and fill the site, to install retaining walls if required, and even the cost to construct the driveway. The steeper the site, the more difficult vehicle access can become, and the steeper the driveway. Remember too that not all drivers are comfortable with steep driveways, and so if you are relying on selling the end product, a steep driveway may be a turn-off for some buyers. And finally, remember that sewerage does not run uphill, and so if you have a sloping site, the location of the sewer main is critical. If the sewer main is not lower than the dwelling, so the sewer can naturally run downhill, you will need to consult with an engineer in terms of the options. While there are mechanical sewer pump systems available, not all councils will accept their use because of the potential issues if the pump fails. The slope of a site can be determined roughly by looking at the lay of the land. Looking at other sites of known slope will help you get a feel for what a 5% slope looks like against a 20% plus slope. Some councils will also have contour maps of areas in the Shire that will give you a guide. To be accurate, however, you will need to have a contour survey completed for the site. From the contour lines, you will be able to determine the slope of the land. An experienced person with a laser level, like a builder, will also be able to shoot the levels of the ground to give an indication of the slope. If you are building a single house, the builder's level may be sufficient. But if you are doing a development, then a contour survey will be required. Slip-prone areas. Another aspect of steep sites can be the slip-prone nature of the substrate. Not all steep sites are slip-prone, though, as it relates to the underlying geology. Slip, otherwise known as landslip, is the rapid downward movement of rock and soil, and obviously building on these areas can be problematic. Developing on these sites can equally be constrained by council, and so knowing if your site is subject to slip is critical. Again, this is not something you want to find out once it is too late to do something about it. A geotechnical engineer is the consultant that can quantify the status of the site, and the structural engineer will then use this information to determine what needs to be done during construction to comply with the required regulations. Using consultants that are local to your area is advisable, as they understand the soil and the geology of the region, and the ways to accommodate this in the local building environment. Otherwise, there is the potential with a non-local consultant that they may overstate the issue. Either way, constructing on a property in a slip-prone area, even if just a garage, can add significantly to the cost, so you need to be aware of this. It is not just if you are developing or constructing on a site, though, that this has relevance. Even if you are completing a renovation with the intention to sell at the end, buyers may be put off by the fact that the site is in a slip-prone area. They may not want the anguish every time it rains, of worrying if the building is going to move or not. Hence, the marketability of your product can be affected. Soil type, swelling and cracking clays, acid sulfate soil. While we are talking about all things underground, another aspect to consider is the soil type. If you are planning to construct on a site, having the soil type characterized by a soil test is essential. This is because different soil properties will impact on the design of the building foundations, including the depth and nature of the footings. A reactive soil type, like a crackly clay that swells when wet and shrinks when dry, can be problematic for footings and foundations, and their cost can increase considerably. Also, underground piping can be affected by this movement, and additional measures may need to be taken during construction to protect them. Clearly, all this comes at a cost. And if you have not factored this in, it could turn a profitable deal into a less profitable one. For this reason, it is not uncommon for purchase contracts to be subject to a soil test to accommodate this uncertainty. Acid sulfate soil is naturally occurring and is formed by bacterial activity in waterlogged conditions. This is common in coastal areas where the soil was once covered by water. In their undisturbed state, acid sulfate soils pose little or no risk. Once they are disturbed and exposed to oxygen, however, they oxidise and produce sulfuric acid. This has the potential to impact on environmental values, but it also has the potential to cause metal to corrode and concrete, bricks and mortar to break down or crack more quickly. Metal pipes, fittings and joins that are buried underground may also corrode at an accelerated rate. As a result, structures and materials may require increased maintenance and may need to be replaced earlier than they otherwise would. This is not something that you need to be alarmed about, as it is quite common, particularly in coastal areas, but it is something that you need to be aware of, as it may impact on the extent of excavation that is able to be done on site, and it may impact on aspects of the construction of the on these soils. Coastal councils may even have acid sulphate soil overlay maps for their shire, which will give you a heads up on their location. There's an example below. Rock. Rock is clearly the other underground factor that needs to be considered if you plan to construct on a site, or even if you are doing a subdivision, because services may still need to be installed underground. Rock is one of those factors that can definitely turn a profitable deal into a less profitable one if significant excavation or rock breaking is required. Unfortunately, there is no council overlay for this, and a soil test of the site needs to be undertaken to identify if rock exists. It is critical, however, that the soil test is done within the footprint of the build area and not in areas that will not be built on or dug for services installation. The larger the project, the more soil boreholes you should have profiled. This is because it is cheaper to pay for more boreholes and accurately quantify any existing rock and the nature of that rock, rather than to find this out at the beginning of construction and have your budget blown out significantly due to variations and time delays. You are much better to understand the site conditions upfront and include this in the project feasibility, or still have the option to pull out of the deal if the likely cost will move the project into negative territory. Contaminated sites. A contaminated site is one where the soil, water, or air has been affected by one or more substances that are actually or potentially hazardous to health or the environment. Soil contamination is the one more likely to impact with regards to property because it can restrict what you can do on the site. There is a contaminated land register that your solicitor will be able to search to ensure the property is not listed. But then there are more localised potential contamination issues, for example, a history of industry on the site or illegal dumping or burying of asbestos on the site. Another more specific example is where the soil beneath a timber garage has potential oil contamination and oil drums and petrol drums buried underground. These are unregistered incidents, but things that you still need to look out for and manage appropriately. Potentially, the petrol and oil drums may need to be filled with a concrete slurry, and the soil may need to be completely excavated and replaced or aerated to release the chemical contaminants, depending on the issues. Obviously, a qualified specialist like an engineer or soil contamination expert needs to be consulted in these situations. Underground water contamination is another aspect to be aware of. For example, there are parts of eastern Sydney where the groundwater has become contaminated by industry in the past. This still impacts the properties in the area, though, and for example, you cannot access bore water on these sites. These are the potentially negative impacts from contamination, but there are also potential opportunities for those that are highly skilled in this area. People that have specialist experience in the identification and management of these types of sites may actually target these problem sites because they have the unique capacity to solve the problem. Clearly, this is not for the majority of people, but it is something to be noted because maybe there are specific skills that you have that could turn someone else's problem into a potential opportunity for you. Cultural heritage. Many councils have identified areas within their shire that they want to preserve the look and feel of. These may be called cultural heritage areas or streetscape preservation areas or demolition control areas, to name a few. They may be individual streets right up to complete suburbs and are likely to be reflected on a map overlay. Each council may differ in regard to what they will allow to occur in these designated areas. The restrictions may range from requiring you to apply to council to even paint the front of the dwelling, through to preventing you from moving the dwelling even on the same block of land, or prevent you from moving the dwelling off the site and moving it to another site, or preventing you from demolishing all or part of the dwelling. If you intend to develop or construct in these areas, council may impose requirements that the new build needs to be of a particular style and even colour palette to ensure it complements the existing streetscape. Understanding if your property is impacted by any of these restrictions and understanding these restrictions upfront is critical. For example, if your strategy required you to demolish or relocate the existing dwelling, but in fact council will not approve it in that area, this could turn it from a potentially profitable deal into a dud. Again, you don't want to find this out too late in the process. Another very important aspect of cultural heritage is areas identified as significant from an Aboriginal and Indigenous culture perspective. Certainly, if you are looking to develop a site, Council will include this as part of the approval process. Again, this may impact on what you can do on the site and how you go about doing the site works. For example, you may be required to hire an archaeologist and/or local Aboriginal elders to inspect the site during excavation to ensure that any unearthed artefacts of significance are handled and managed with cultural sensitivity. Heritage listed buildings. Individual buildings of heritage significance have also been identified at a council, state and national level. At a council level, they may be reflected on mapping overlays, and you or your town planner will need to research this. At a national level, there is a heritage register that lists protected properties, and your solicitor will be able to undertake a search of this. Again, there will be very strict regulations dictating what works can be done on those buildings and sites, and so thorough research is required. Opportunities also exist, though, to apply for funding grants to assist with the maintenance and renovation of these structures, and so again, research into this is recommended. Above ground infrastructure at the front of the property. While we are focusing on property specific due diligence, another aspect to be aware of is the presence of the above ground infrastructure at the front of the property, for example, power poles, road signs and other signage, bus stops, traffic lights, roundabouts, fire hydrants, public mailboxes, car parks and parking meters, to name a few. The reason they are significant is because they may not be able to be easily moved, or they may cost a significant amount of money to move them, or take a significant amount of time to get approval to have them moved. Depending on their position, they may hinder you developing the property further, especially if it requires you to widen the driveway or relocate the driveway, and this conflicts with one of these pieces of infrastructure. There may also be buffer zones around this infrastructure, like power poles, and hence, there is a minimum distance away from them that any access driveway must be positioned. Even if the infrastructure is not directly in front of your property, but out the front of a neighbouring property, you may still be impacted by the buffer zone. And so noting the infrastructure around your property and doing the necessary due diligence up front is critical. Council or the Main Roads Department might simply not approve a development in this location, or the cost to get approval and to move the infrastructure may be so prohibitive that the deal is not worth pursuing. For example, getting approval and relocating a power pole housing major transformer infrastructure could take months, up to a year, and cost tens of thousands of dollars, if not over $100,000, depending on the size, so they are not something to be complacent about. The flip side of the situation above is where you know that currently restrictive structures may in fact be flagged for removal, and that this could actually improve the development potential or the value of the site. Maybe you have some inside knowledge that something is planned for removal, and this could benefit the site. An example of this is a site where there are some significant power infrastructure across the road from a property which adversely affected its ocean views. It was not common knowledge. However, through extensive research, it was discovered that in fact the piece of infrastructure was flagged for decommissioning in the future, and hence its removal would significantly improve the ocean view of the property, and therefore its market value. Underground infrastructure. Examples of underground infrastructure are those items that may be out the front of your property or actually on your site, including manholes, disused septic tanks, buried water tanks, and Telstra pits, for example. These generally will not prevent you from developing the site, but their cost to relocate or remove needs to be factored in, as too does the time frame to have them disapproved. For example, even a disused septic tank needs to be officially decommissioned. It may have been made out of asbestos-containing material and so needs to be removed appropriately. And finally, the hole that it leaves needs to be correctly refilled and compacted if you intend to build over the area, even if it is a driveway. This is because subsidence can result if it's not sufficiently compacted and the driveway could be rendered unusable. If a council or an engineering inspection is part of the process, which is likely if it is a development project, then you run the risk of them not approving the works, costing you both time and money. So even something as simple as filling a hole has implications that need to be considered. Similarly, if you intend to fill in a swimming pool, Do your research on this upfront so that you understand what's involved and factor it into the project. One final point on manholes or person holes is that there is generally a buffer zone around them in which you cannot build. Obviously, this can affect your proposed site layout, and so understanding this early in the process is imperative. Services location. These services include the water main, sewer main, stormwater, power, phone, and gas. They will not be covered in any great detail here because they were covered in depth in Module 5 and touched on above in this module. If you intend to develop the site to any extent, the important thing is to know where these services are located relative to your site. For example, if the water main is across the road, you may have to do an under-road bore to connect into it, and obviously this comes at a cost. If the services dissect your property, for example a sewer main, you need to understand what the implications are. Can you build over it or not? If yes, then what can be built? For example, a driveway is usually okay, but what about a carport or an actual habitable dwelling or a pergola? If you can build over it, what are the design requirements to protect the sewer and what will be the impact on cost? For example, is bridging the sewer an option or can it be encased to preserve its integrity in case it needs to be accessed in the future? If the answer is no and you can't build over the sewer, then what buffer distance do you need to be away from it and can you design around this? A civil engineer will be able to advise you on these questions. Take an existing power pole as another example. The electrical companies will not allow the power line feeding one property to cross over the land of an adjoining property. This can become a problem when you subdivide a block because you may find that the position of the existing power pole may contravene this rule and the overhead line may cross a portion of the new block. In this case, a new property power pole will need to be installed to service the new block. It is not a huge cost, but it is a cost, and it can delay the project if you are not proactive. An electrician will be able to advise you on this one. Capacity of services. Another important consideration if you are developing a site and increasing the intensity of dwellings is the actual capacity of the existing services, particularly power and water. For example, just because you have power to the current site, you cannot just assume that there will be sufficient power lines available to service your development. This is particularly the case if you are adding more than four dwellings, because this seems to push it into the commercial zone. This can be common in less built-up areas or newly emerging areas, where the infrastructure may be limited. It does happen, though, in built-up areas too. Several students have been advised by the power supply companies that a larger transformer will need to be installed to service their units, and that this will take 12 months and at a cost to them of over $30,000 each. This did not come to light until nearing the end of the construction process, so starting your due diligence on this as soon as possible in the development approval process is recommended, so that you can either tick this off as being done or immediately start the negotiations to have it rectified. There are electrical engineer consultants that should be able to assist in this due diligence, as well as liaising with the power supplier in your area that owns the infrastructure, for example, Ergon and Energex in Queensland. Water pressure is another factor and something that you need to ensure will be adequate, particularly if your project is large. This may not mean just increasing the size of the main water meter to your project, but possibly the actual water main may need to be upgraded in size. Obviously, this is a costly and time-consuming process. A consultant hydraulics engineer should be able to investigate this for you. Shared services between properties. Who would have thought there was so much due diligence associated with services? What I am referring to here is the situation where services are shared between adjoining properties, and so when you come to do work on your property, it in fact affects the neighbour. The most common example of this is when the sewer drain is shared between adjoining properties, called a combined sewer drain. Rather than each property having their own sewer drain that connects directly into the sewer main, instead, you have the pipework from multiple properties converging and connecting into just one sewer drain on one of the properties. Therefore, there is just one sewer connection into the sewer main, instead of there being an individual connection into the sewer main for each separate property. This was commonly done years ago as a way to save costs when council were originally installing the services. Therefore, it is something that you find particularly in the older, well-established suburbs. It is certainly not something that is done in modern estates. The problem with this arrangement is that if you plan to do any development of your site, council can require you to rectify the situation. This is because if your property is the one with the combined drain located on it and the neighbours are all feeding into it, then as soon as you go to do any work on your sewer line, it will impact on all of the adjoining properties. Conversely, if you are one of the adjoining properties and you want to develop your site, then in effect, you do not actually have a direct connection to the sewer main because it is in the property with the combined sewer drain. So you can see that in both instances, this needs to be rectified for you to develop the site. Obtaining a copy of the house drain plan from council should reflect the nature of your sewer connection, as will the sewer main infrastructure plan. If you do not see your property on these plans as having a direct branch into the sewer main, like the example below, then this needs to raise some questions. Adjoining properties and structures next to the boundary. While we are talking about neighbouring properties, there are some other aspects that need to be considered in your due diligence, both from a negative and a positive perspective. In all examples, you need to be aware of the other properties around you and in the street. If you are planning to do any construction on your site, you need to be aware of and sympathetic to the privacy of the adjoining properties. If you are developing the site, it will get picked up in the development approval process. The types of things referred to here are the positions of the windows and doors of the neighbouring property along the side boundaries, as this will affect the location of your windows and the requirement for screening to those windows. Even the position of their balconies, verandas, and private open space along the side boundary can impact you.